bought 3 or 4 more cars from him after that. Gary knew a little about what happened to me, but no details. He was a race car driver as well as a car dealer. He seemed fascinated with my story. He had said he'd like to hear the whole story one day, but either he was too busy or I had to rush on. One day, Joe went to the dealership to make a payment. Gary waved him over. "You'll never believe this," the man grinned. "An amazing thing happened yesterday." "What?" "I went to check out a car that we had just bought. I got inside the car to do the things I usually do, you know, punch all the buttons to see if everything works. Things like listen to the engine for any defects, check the air conditioner, see if the radio works. I noticed a tape inside the cassette deck. I pushed the eject button." He paused and smiled. "Bet you'll never guess what was on the tape." "I have no idea," said Joe. "It was your dad's story. We had bought the car in an auction, so there was no owner to give the tape back to. I took the tape and listened to it. The only thing I could think of when I heard it was one word. Awesome." As I look back, it's amazing. Gary had wanted to hear my story, but we had just not gotten together. What are the odds of my going to an automobile auction with thousands of cars for sale, Gary asked Joe, that I sit inside one, push a button, and hear your dad talking? For days after that, I think Gary must have told everyone he talked to about my accident. Of course, that testimony thrilled me. I've also heard many other stories of the way God has used my story. I had made a tape of my experience while preaching in my church, Pasadena's First Baptist, and had it duplicated. I must have distributed thousands of them. I also know people took the tape and copied it for their friends. I know people who ordered as many as 20 tapes over a period of months. That testimonial tape just keeps going on and on. Many who have heard my story duplicated it for people going through physical trauma themselves or those who are dealing with the loss of a loved one. I can only conclude that God had a plan for Gary Emmons to hear that tape and made sure he did. One day, while I was walking down the hallway of First Baptist Church of Pasadena, a woman stopped me. That's not unusual, of course. In fact, my wife jokes that it takes me 30 minutes to walk 20 feet because everyone has something he or she needs to ask me or tell me. We have over 10,000 members. That's a lot of folks to get around to. "Oh, Reverend Piper, I came by just to see you. I want to tell you something, something I think you need to hear." Usually, when someone starts out that way, he usually adds, "It's for your own good." And it's usually not something I want to hear. Several other people were with me, and I wasn't sure how to react. As I stared at her, however, I sensed an urgency in her face and a deep intensity. I turned to the others and asked, "Would you mind?" They were gracious, of course. "I'm a registered nurse, and you will never believe what happened." "I've had a lot of unbelievable things happen. Just try me." This happened at the hospital. A woman whose mother was very ill and hospitalized was able to hear your tape, and it changed her life. I had heard that before, but I never minded hearing new stories, so I said, "Tell me more." Someone brought her this tape, and she wasn't a believer, but the person wanted her to listen to the tape anyway. Her friends had tried to talk to her about God. They had given her Bibles, all kinds of books and pamphlets, but nothing affected her. She said, "I don't want to talk about God, religion, or salvation." Even though she was terminally ill, she wasn't open to any message about eternity. She paused to wipe a tear from her eyes before she continued. "Someone brought her a tape, your tape, about your experience in heaven, and asked her if she would listen to it. The friend didn't press it, but said something casual like, 'You might find this helpful. It's about a man who died, went to heaven, and came back to life again.' The nurse told me that the woman said that she might listen to it if she thought about it." The friend left. The tape lay on the stand next to her bed, unheard. Her health soon deteriorated so badly that doctors told her daughter that it was only a matter of a week, two at the most. The daughter, who was a believer, desperately wanted her mother to hear the tape of my testimony. The tape contains two messages. The first side tells of the miracles that had to happen for me to live, and recounts the answered prayer that took place for me to live, as I've written about earlier in this book. The second side of the tape tells about what heaven is like. I call it the cure for heart trouble. That's the part the daughter wanted her mother to listen to. But the woman refused. "I don't want to listen to all that stuff," she said. Days went by, and the older woman's condition grew more desperate. The nurse who was talking to me, and who was a Christian, realized what was going on. After she talked with her daughter, the nurse decided to talk to the patient herself about her soul, something she had not done before. She reasoned that sometimes it's easier for a stranger or someone less known to give a positive witness than it is for a family member. After working her shift, the nurse walked into the room and asked, "May I sit down and talk to you for a few minutes?" The dying woman nodded. Gently and discreetly, the nurse talked about faith and God's peace and how much of a difference Jesus Christ had made in her own life. The whole time, the woman said nothing. The nurse mentioned the tape. "I've heard it, and I think it's something you would like to know. Would you like to listen to the tape?" The old woman nodded. So the nurse put the tape in the cassette recorder and left. The next day, the dying woman told her daughter and the nurse that she had listened to the tape. "I found it very interesting. I'm seriously thinking about becoming a Christian." Even though the nurse and the daughter rejoiced, they didn't try to persuade the dying woman. 2 days passed before the woman said, "I have become a believer." She told her daughter first and then the nurse. After that, no matter who came into the room to see her, the dying woman would say, "I have become a Christian. I've accepted Jesus Christ as my Savior, and I'm going to heaven." Within hours after her publicly telling others about her conversion, the woman's condition deteriorated. She drifted in and out of consciousness. The next day, when the nurse came on duty, she learned that the old woman had died only minutes earlier. The nurse told me all of that and then said, "You won't believe what was happening during those final moments while she was dying." Before I could ask, she said, the tape recorder was on the bed beside her, and her daughter had put in the second side of your tape where you describe heaven. As her life drifted away, she was listening to your account of what heaven is like. The last thing she heard before she left this world to join God in heaven was a description of heaven. Despite my trying to remain stoic, tears seeped from the corner of my eyes. "I just thought you'd like to know that." "Yes," I said. "Thank you for telling me. That's great encouragement for me." As she retold some of the story to those with me, I thank God for bringing me back to earth. "Oh, God, I do see some of your purpose in my staying here. Thank you for allowing me to hear this story." One time I preached at the Chocolate Bayou Baptist Church just south of Houston. They had asked me to share my death and heaven experience. I was getting my final thoughts together. Typically, in Baptist churches, they have a soloist or some kind of special music just before the guest speaker comes to the pulpit. A woman, who had not been in the service and apparently didn't know what I was going to talk about, came in from a side door to sing. She had a lovely voice and began to sing a song called "Broken and Spilled Out," about the alabaster jar the woman used when she washed Jesus' feet. As soon as she sat down, I stood up and began to tell them about my accident. I didn't make any connection between her song and my message, but I noticed that several people kept frowning at the woman. After the service, I heard someone say to the soloist, "That was an interesting song about being broken and spilled out for you to sing before Don talked." The way he said interesting really meant tasteless. "Oh," she said. The shock on her face made me aware that she hadn't known what I was going to speak about. Obviously, she hadn't made the connection either. Our eyes met and she started to cry. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. "That's fine," I said. "Really, it's all right." I started to walk on. "Broken and spilled out," someone said. "That's what happened to you, wasn't it?" At least a dozen people made similar comments. A few assumed we had planned for her to sing that particular song. I stopped and looked back. The soloist stood next to the piano and she was crying. I excused myself and walked back to her. "That's a beautiful song, about a wonderful experience. You didn't know what I was going to talk about, but that's all right, because I can't think of a better song." She smiled in gratefulness and started to apologize again. "It's fine. Really, really, it's fine," I assured her. As I walked away, I thought maybe I had been broken and spilled out. But I smiled at another idea. I'm also being put back together again. Chapter 16. Finding Purpose. Philippians 1:25. "I am convinced of this, so I will continue with you so that you will grow and experience the joy of your faith." Philippians 1:25. Brad Turpin, a motorcycle police officer from the Houston suburb of Pasadena, almost lost a leg. His police motorcycle crashed into the back of a flatbed truck. He would have bled out on the concrete if the EMTs hadn't applied a tourniquet to his leg. Sonny Steed, the former minister of education at our church, knew Brad personally and asked me to go see him. "Absolutely," I said, especially after I heard that he would be wearing a fixator. I called and made sure he'd let me come. I don't know why, but just before we left, I picked up pictures showing my accident and my recovery. Sonny drove me to the officer's home. Once we had walked inside, it was almost like seeing the way my living room had looked for months. Brad was lying in a hospital bed with a trapeze bar above him. His device was similar, but not quite the same as mine, because in the dozen years since my accident, technology had improved. Other people were there, so I sat down and joined in casual conversation. He was nice enough, but I knew he'd seen so many people he was tired of visitors. As soon as the last visitor left, I said, "You're really tired of talking to people, aren't you?" Brad nodded. "I understand. You almost feel like you're on display here. The phone never stops ringing. Everybody wants to come by to see you." He nodded again. "I appreciate them coming, but I need some peace and quiet. I apologize for interrupting you, but Sonny brought me to see you because I want to talk to you about what to expect." I pointed to the Elizaroff and said, "I had one of these external fixators." "Oh, you did?" I showed him my pictures, beginning with those taken the day after they put on the Elizaroff frame. Each one showed the progression to the next step. He stared at each one closely and saw that I had been worse off than he was. "And you recovered, didn't you?" "Yes, I did, and so will you." "That's good that you made it all right, but I don't think I'm going to make it. They can't give me any guarantee that I'm going to keep this leg. The doctors are pessimistic, so that makes it harder for me." "Well, that's just the way they are," I said, remembering so well my feelings in those early days. "They try to err on the side of being conservative and try not to get your hopes up. Months from now, they know you could have this fixator and everything could be working fine, and then your leg gets infected and you could still lose it." "That's what I mean. I'm not sure it's worth all this pain." "The good news is that the pain will ease as you get better." His wife had walked in during the conversation and listened. "I'm just so tired of the lack of progress, and nobody will tell us anything," she said. "We're about ready to change doctors." "You might find a better doctor," I said. "But wait a bit. Be patient. I'm sure your doctor is doing his best. Then I told him about the time I reached the end of my patience. When my doctor came in to see me, I was fuming. Sit down, I yelled. He did, and for maybe 5 minutes I complained about everything that bothered and upset me. As I watched his face, I realized I had hurt his feelings. I hadn't been thinking about him, of course. I was hurting, never pain-free, couldn't sleep, and I wanted answers. I get tired of all this not knowing. I ask you how long I have to wear this, and you say, maybe another month, maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months. I wasn't through yet, and my anger really burst out with another round of complaints. I ended up with, why can't you give me a straight answer? He dropped his head and said softly, I'm doing the best I can. I don't know the answers. That's why I can't tell you. I'm just looking for, I know you are, but this isn't an exact science. We're reinventing the wheel. We don't have that much experience in this area, and this is all new technology to us. We're doing the best we can. After I told Brad and his wife about the incident, I added, please be patient with your doctor. He can't give you answers he doesn't have. He'll also tell you things to do and load you down with prescriptions. He's going to put you in a lot of therapy, and you're just going to have to learn how to deal with it, with all of it. Yeah, I know, he said, but I just can't control my emotions anymore. I'm a cop. I've seen a lot of hard, bad, difficult stuff. I find myself just breaking down. I mean, real emotional. Know what I mean? Absolutely. Just go ahead and break down. It'll happen again. I feel out of control. You are out of control. Brad stared at me. Think about it. What can you control? Nothing. I can't even wipe myself. That's right. You're totally helpless. There's nothing you can do or control. Before this, I was a weightlifter and bodybuilder, he said. I had a physique you wouldn't believe. I have no doubt about that. I could see that he had once been muscular and strong. But you don't have that now. You may have a great body again someday, but the inability to get up and do the things you used to do will cause you to change. Be prepared to change. You're going to lose weight, muscles will atrophy, you can't control your body the way you did before. His wife was obviously feeling all the stress as well, and she was on the verge of tears. He just feels so bad, even with medication. I just don't know what to do. I can suggest a few things. First of all, manage the visits and phone calls. You don't have to let everyone come whenever they want, I said. Be firm. If you allow everyone to come, you'll wear yourself out trying to be nice. Your friends will understand. Then I turned to Brad. Be prepared for all your therapy, because you're going to have to do all kinds of difficult things. Do them if you want to learn to walk again. Be patient, because it will take a long time. Probably one of the best things I can tell you is this. Don't try to act like the Lone Ranger. I paused briefly and almost smiled, because I remembered how I had been. Let people know where you hurt and how they can help, especially the people you trust. Let them know so they can do things for you. Let them pray for you. You've got a lot of nice folks coming by here, and they want to bring you a cake, cook a meal, or do something for you. Let them express their friendship and love. After I had talked a few minutes, I got up to leave. I wrote down my phone number. Call me. If you're struggling to go to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning or you're angry, call me. I'll listen. I'll understand because I can understand. It's a small fraternity, and none of us joined it by choice. Before I left, Brad said, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming by. Just visiting with somebody who knows about the pain helps me a lot. You're the first person I've met who understands what it's like to live with pain 24 hours a day. It's not something I set out to do, visiting people who are where I was, I said, but I'm willing to do it I want to help, but you're going to have to make the effort to call me. Remember, don't try to tough it out alone. Brad's wife followed me out to the car and said he needed this. In public, he tries to be the source of strength and sound positive. In quiet moments, he's frustrated and emotional, and he falls apart. I've been really worried about him. Never in our lives together have I seen him this way. I remember my wife working hard all day teaching school and then coming to spend the evening with me, I said. Just hang in with him. He will get better. I told her that one time when I was at my worst, Eva had tried to encourage me and had said something like, "Just give it time. You're going to be fine." I had exploded with frustration and rage. What makes you think I'm going to be fine? What are the odds of my ever being fine? Nobody can ever tell me that. Nobody can promise me that. To her credit, Eva hadn't argued. She wrapped her arms around me. I had wept. I had never done that before in her presence. After I had told that story to Brad's wife, I said, "Be prepared for changes in your life and his. He can't control his emotions, but don't take it as a personal attack when he yells and screams. It's the pain and the frustration, not you." I shook her hand and said, "And for goodness sakes, call me if you need me. Push Brad to call me." After that, I saw Brad 4 or 5 times. Weeks later, when he was able to get out of the house with his walker, I spotted him in a restaurant. I went over to his table and sat down. "How are you doing?" I asked. "I'm doing okay, really okay." He thanked me again for coming at one of his lowest moments. He still wasn't in top shape, but he was getting healthy again. When he clasped my hand and held it a long time, I knew it was his way of expressing his appreciation in ways he couldn't put in words. I felt grateful to God for being able to help Brad in his dark time. About 2 years after my accident, I heard that Chad Val had been in a serious car accident. He had been a member of our youth ministry at South Park, and his parents were among the most supportive parents I had at the church. His mother, Carol, was on the committee that came to my hospital room with others to plan youth events. I hadn't been very helpful, but it had been their way of making me feel useful and needed. Chad had been an outstanding soccer player and was with our youth group about a year before he went to college. When I called his mother, she told me they had helicoptered Chad to John Seeley Hospital in Galveston. I had no idea just how serious he was until she added, "The report is that he mangled his lower leg and is in a fixator." When I heard the word fixator, I knew I had to see him. I would have gone anyway, because he was a member of South Park, but the word fixator gave extra urgency. When I walked into his room, Chad lay there depressed, and he obviously didn't want to talk. This wasn't the Chad I knew. Before that, he'd always been glad to see me, and his face would light up in recognition. This time he acknowledged my presence but made no effort to engage in conversation. "Are you okay? Are you going to be all right?" I asked and looked at his leg. "I see they gave you a fixator." "Yeah, they did," he said. "Chad, you remember when I had my accident? That's the same thing they put on me." "Really?" he asked. For the first time, he looked at me with interest. I don't know if he'd never seen me with mine or if he just didn't remember. I leaned closer and said, "Just remember this. I know what it feels like to have one of them." His injury was on the lower leg. Because there are 2 bones in the lower leg, it's less difficult to heal. As I learned before I left, his prognosis was very good. I was able to talk to that boy, hold his hand, pray with him in a way that made him realize I identified with his plight. For the first time, he had a sense of what he had to look forward to in his treatment. Until then, like me after my accident, no one would give Chad any specific information. Like me, he felt angry and depressed. The pain will last a long time, and the recovery will seem to last forever, but you'll get better. better. Just remember that. You will get better. And he did. Cancer claimed Joyce Pentecost 1 week before her 39th birthday. I loved her very much. She was married to Eva's brother Eddie and left behind two beautiful red-headed kids, Jordan and Colton. Not only was Joyce one of the liveliest people I've ever met and a fireball of a singer, she could also light up a room by merely entering it. She rarely just sang a song. She belted it in the great tradition of Ethel Merman. I felt honored to speak at her memorial service at First Baptist Church of Forest City, Arkansas. More than 600 people packed the auditorium. Because Joyce had recorded several CDs of Christian music, she left a legacy for the rest of us. On that Sunday afternoon, we heard Joyce sing her own benediction. Following her recorded music, her father, Reverend Charles Bradley, delivered a message of hope and salvation. He told the crowd, "Years ago, Joyce and I made a covenant. If I were first, she would sing at my funeral. And if she went first, I would speak at hers. Today, I am fulfilling that promise to my baby girl." That moment still stays with me. Melancholy smiles broke out, tears flowed, but I don't think anyone felt anger or hopelessness. After Joyce's father concluded his message, it was my turn to speak. Someone may ask today, "How could Joyce die?" I said. But I would say to you, the better question is, how did she live? She lived well, beloved. She lived very well. I told the hurting throng that Joyce was a red-headed comet streaking across the stage of life, that she lived and loved to make people happy, that she was a devoted friend, an ideal daughter, a doting aunt, a sweet sister, a loving mother, and a wonderful wife. I admitted freely that I didn't have the answer to the question that must have penetrated many hearts in that room. Why? "There is comfort when there are no answers," I said. Joyce firmly believed that if she died, she would instantly be with God. She believed that if she lived, God would be with her. That was her reason for living. That can be our reason for carrying on. I concluded by sharing one personal moment. The last extended conversation I had with Joyce before she returned home from the hospital was about heaven. She never tired of hearing me describe my trip to heaven, so we visited there one final time. We talked of the angels, the gate, and our loved one. Joyce's own mother had died of cancer. Joyce always wanted me to describe the music, and our final conversation together was no different. "Just a few days ago," I said to the congregation, "I believe God was sitting behind those gates, and he told the angels, 'What we need around here is a good red-headed soprano.'" "That would be Joyce Pentecost," the angel said. "God sent for Joyce, and she answered the call. She is singing now with the angelic hosts. Joyce Pentecost is absent from the body, but present with the Lord." My final words at that service were a question. Can you lose someone if you know where she is? I was 38 years old when I was killed in that car wreck. Joyce was the same age when she was diagnosed with cancer. I survived the ordeal. Joyce did not. But I know this. Because I was able to experience heaven, I was able to prepare her and her loved ones for it. And now, I am preparing you. Many times since my accident, I have wished someone who had already gone through the ordeal of wearing a fixator for months, had visited me in the hospital. I know it would have relieved a lot of my anxiety. Whenever I hear about people having a fixator, I try to contact them. When I talk to those facing long-term illness, I try to be totally honest. There is no easy way through that recovery process, and they need to know that. Because I've been there, I can tell them, and they listen, that although it will take a long time, eventually they will get better. I also talk to them about some of the short-term problems they'll face. My visits with Chad and Brad and others also reminded me that God still has a purpose for me on earth. During that long recovery period, I sometimes longed for heaven. Looking back, however, I can see how the personal experiences I have shared with others provided a gentle pull earthward when I was in heaven. When God is ready to take me, I was finally able to say, He'll release me. In the meantime, I try to offer as much comfort as possible to others. Like me, when other victims first see the fixator attached to their leg, and especially when they begin to experience the pain and their inability to move, depression flows through them. They have no idea what's going to happen next. Even though doctors try to reassure them of recovery, they hurt too much to receive comfort from the doctor's words. Sometimes, however, the patient may be inadvertently misled into saying to me, "I'll get over this soon." "You may get over it, but it won't be soon," I say. "This is a long-term commitment, and there's no way to speed up the process. When you face injuries of this magnitude, there is no easy way out. You have to live with it for now." I could share other stories, but these are the experiences that kept me going through some of my own dark periods. I found purpose again in being alive. I still long to return to heaven, but for now, this is where I belong. I am serving my purpose here on earth. Chapter 17, Longing for Home. Colossians 1:5. You do this because you are looking forward to the joys of heaven, as you have ever since you first heard the truth of the good news. Colossians 1:5. One of my favorite stories is about a little girl who left her house, and her mother didn't know where she had gone. Once the mother missed her, she worried that something might have happened to her child. She stood on the front porch and yelled her daughter's name several times. Almost immediately, the little girl ran from the house next door. The mother hugged her and said she was worried, and finally asked, "Where have you been?" "I was next door to be with Mr. Smith." "Why were you over there?" "His wife died, and he is very sad." "Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know that," the mother said. "What did you do?" "I just helped him cry." In a way, that's what I do. Sharing my experiences is my way of crying with others in pain. I've discovered one reason I can bring comfort to people who are facing death themselves or have suffered the loss of a loved one. I've been there. I can give them every assurance that heaven is a place of unparalleled and indescribable joy. Without the slightest doubt, I know heaven is real. It's more real than anything I have ever experienced in my life. I sometimes say, think of the worst thing that's ever happened to you, the best thing that's ever happened to you, and everything in between. Heaven is more real than any of those things. Since my return to earth, I've been acutely aware that all of us are on a pilgrimage. At the end of this life, wherever we go, heaven or hell, life will be more real than this one we're now living. I never thought of that before my accident, of course. Heaven was a concept, something I believed in, but I didn't think about it often. In the years since my accident, I've repeatedly thought of the last night Jesus was with his disciples before his betrayal and crucifixion. Only hours before he began that journey to heaven, he sat with his disciples in the upper room. He begged them not to be troubled and to trust in him. Then he told them that he was going away and added, "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am." John 14:2-3. I had never really noticed it before, but twice Jesus used the word place, a location. Perhaps that may not stir most people, but I think about it often. It is a literal place, and I can testify, I know that place. I've been there. I know heaven is real. Since my accident, I felt more intensely and deeply than ever before. A year in a hospital bed can do that for anyone, but it was more than just that. Those 90 minutes in heaven left such an impression on me that I can never be the same person I was. I can never again be totally content here because I live in anticipation. I've experienced more pain than I thought a human could endure and still live to tell about it. In spite of all that happened to me during those months of unrelenting pain, I still feel the reality of heaven far, far more than the suffering I endured. Because I am such a driven person and hardly ever slow down, I have often felt I needed to explain why I can't do certain things. When I'm fully dressed, most folks would never realize I have such debilitating injuries. However, when I face an activity that this reconstructed body just can't do, and people sometimes are surprised how simple some of those acts are, I often get strange responses. "You look healthy," more than one person has said. "What's the matter with you?" Occasionally, when I follow someone down a flight of stairs, a difficult experience for me, they hear my knees grinding and turn around. "Is that awful noise coming from you?" they asked. "Yes," I smile and add, "isn't it ridiculous?" My relative mobility is quite deceptive. I get around better than anyone imagined I would, but I know, even if it doesn't show, that I'm quite limited in what I can do. I work hard to walk properly because I don't want to attract attention to myself. I had enough stares and gawks when I wore my fixator. Trying to act and look normal and to keep pushing myself is my way of dealing with my infirmities. I've learned that if I stay busy, especially by helping others, I don't think about my pain. In an odd way, my pain is its own therapy. I intend to go on until I can't go anymore. We are such victims of our human invention of time that we have to think in temporal concepts. It's the way we're wired. That's an important point for me to make. My human inclination is to wonder what my welcoming committee is doing during these years while I've been back on Earth. As I ponder this, I don't believe my greeting committee said, "Oh no, he doesn't get to stay." They're still there at the gate. They're waiting. For them, time is not passing. Everything is in the eternal now, even if I can't put that into words. Even if 10 more years pass, or 30, in heaven, it will only be an instant before I'm back there again. Going to heaven that January morning wasn't my choice. The only choice in all of this is that one day I turned to Jesus Christ and accepted him as my Savior. Unworthy as I am, he allowed me to go to heaven. And I know the next time I go there, I'll stay. I don't have a death wish. I'm not suicidal, but every day I think about going back. I long to return. In God's timing, I know with utter certainty that I will. Now I look forward to that time and eagerly await that moment. I have absolutely no fear of death. Why would I? There's nothing to fear, only joy to experience. As I've pointed out before, when I became conscious again on earth, a bitter disappointment raged through me. I didn't want to return, but it wasn't my choice. For a long time, I didn't accept that God had sent me back. But even in my disappointment, I knew that God had a purpose in everything that happened. There was a reason I went to heaven and a purpose in my returning. Eventually, I grasped that God had given me a special experience and a glimpse of what eternity will be. Although I long for my heavenly home, I'm prepared to wait until the final summons comes for me. Going through 34 surgeries and many years of pain has helped me realize the truth of Paul's words to the Corinthians. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our troubles, so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. 2 Corinthians 1, 3, and 4. As long as I'm here on earth, God still has a purpose for me. Knowing that fact enables me to endure the pain and cope with my physical disabilities. In my darkest moments, I remember a line from an old song, "It will be worth it all when we see Jesus." I know it will. Chapter 18, The Why Questions. 1 Corinthians 13, 12. Now we see things imperfectly, as in a poor mirror, but then we will see everything with perfect clarity. All that I know now is partial and incomplete, but then I will know everything completely, just as God knows me now. 1 Corinthians 13, 12. Many times I've watched people on TV who say they've had near-death experiences, NDE. I confess to being fascinated, but I also admit to being skeptical. In fact, I'm highly skeptical. Before and after those people spoke, I thought they've probably had some kind of brain lapse, or maybe there was already something in their memory bank and they just re-experienced it. I don't doubt their sincerity. They wanted to believe what they talked about. I've watched many talk shows and read about victims who had died and been heroically resuscitated. Descriptions of their ordeal often seemed too rehearsed and disturbingly similar, as if one person copied the story of the last. One person who claimed to have been dead for more than 24 hours wrote a book and said he'd talked to Adam and Eve. Some of the things the first earthly couple purportedly told him don't measure up with the Bible. Despite my skepticism, even today, of many of their testimonies, I've never questioned my own death. In fact, it was so powerful, so life-changing, that I couldn't talk about it to anyone until David Gentiles pried out the information almost 2 years after the accident. I have looked at the research on NDE and thought about it often during the years. In December 2001, Lancet, the Journal of the British Medical Society, reported research on NDE. Most scientific and medical experts had previously dismissed these dramatic occurrences as wishful thinking or the misguided musings of oxygen-starved brains. The study conducted in the Netherlands is one of the first scientific studies. Instead of interviewing those who reported they once had an NDE, they followed hundreds of patients who had been resuscitated after suffering clinical death, that is, after their hearts stopped. They hoped that approach would provide more accurate accounts by documenting the experiences as they happened, rather than basing them on recollections long after the event of resuscitation. Their results? About 18% of the patients in the study spoke of recollection of the time in which they had been clinically dead. Between 8 and 12% reported the commonly accepted NDE experiences, such as bright lights, going through a tunnel, or even crossing over into heaven and speaking with dead relatives and friends. The researchers concluded that afterlife experiences, or NDE, are merely something we would all desperately like to believe is true. Conversely, other scholars made conclusions based on their study of 344 people, ages 26 to 92, who had been resuscitated. Most of them were interviewed within 5 days of the experience. The researchers contacted those same people 2 years later and then 8 years after the event. Researchers discovered that the experiences didn't correlate with any of the measured psychological, physiological, or medical parameters. That is, the experiences were unrelated to processes in a dying brain. Most patients had excellent recall of the events, which, the researchers said, undermined the idea that the memories were false. The most important thing to me is that those who had such experiences reported marked changes in their personalities. They lost their fear of death. They became more compassionate, giving, and loving. The study really proved nothing about the reality of NDE. As has been the case before the studies, one group believed NDE was merely the psychological states of those dying. The other group maintained that hard evidence supported the validity of near-death experiences, suggesting that scientists rethink theories that dismiss out-of-body experiences. I have no intention of trying to solve this debate. I can only relate what happened to me. No matter what researchers may or may not try to tell me, I know I went to heaven. I've devoted an immense amount of time to considering why it happened rather than what happened. I have reached only one solid conclusion. Before being killed in a car accident, I remained skeptical of near-death experiences. I simply didn't see how a person could die, go to heaven, and return to tell about it. I never doubted dying, the reality of heaven, or life after death. I doubted descriptions of near-death stories. These stories all seemed too rehearsed and sounded alike. Then I died, went to heaven, and returned. I can only tell what happened to me. Not for an instant have I ever thought it was merely a vision, some case of mental wires crossing, or the results of stories I'd heard. I know heaven is real. I have been there and come back. It comes down to this. Until some mere mortal is dead for a lengthy period and subsequently returns to life with irrefutable evidence of an afterlife, near-death experiences will continue to be a matter of faith, or at the very least, conjecture. But then, as one of my friends would say, what else is new? One time I shared my experiences with a large congregation that included my wife's parents, Eldon and Ethel Pentecost. They had been consistently supportive and made great sacrifices during my accident and lengthy recovery. After the service, we went to their home. At one point, Eldon and I were alone, and he told me, "I was angry the first time you shared your story of your trip to heaven." I had no idea he felt that way. "You finished by saying you never wanted to come back to earth." I just nodded in affirmation, not knowing where this was going. I didn't understand it then, but I've changed. Now, when I hear you talk about heaven's beauty, I understand a little better why you'd willingly be separated from my daughter and grandkids for a while. You know, you really do know, don't you, that they'll join you someday? "Without a doubt," I said. Eldon's revelation caught me off guard. He was right, of course. I had the distinct privilege of baptizing my own children and seeing my wife baptized as well. I knew that their professions of faith were authentic. By faith, I knew that they would be residents of heaven someday. Being separated from them had never crossed my mind while I was in heaven. People in heaven simply don't have any awareness of who is not there. They do know who is coming. Even today, I can say honestly that I wish I could have stayed in heaven. But my ultimate time had not yet come. After leaving heaven, if I had known that I would face 2 weeks in ICU, a year in a hospital bed, and 34 operations, I surely would have been even more disheartened from the onset. However, this was not my choice. And I returned to the sounds of one voice praying, boots crunching glass underfoot, and the jaws of life ripping through my shattered auto. One question keeps troubling me. Why? It takes many forms. Why did I die in that car wreck? Why did I have the unique privilege of going to heaven? Why did I glimpse heaven only to be sent back? Why did I nearly die in the hospital? Why has God let me live in constant pain since January 18th, 1989? The short answer is, I don't know. And yet that single word, why, remains the consummate human query. By nature, we're curious. We want to know. All these years later, it's still not easy for me to relate what happened. Several times I tried to write this myself, but couldn't. That's why I asked my friend, Cece Murphy, to help me with this book. If it were up to me, this book would never have been written. The emotional trauma of reliving all these events is too difficult. Only with someone else actually writing it has it finally been possible to go through this ordeal. I still don't know why such things happen. I know God is with me in the darkest moments of life. Besides asking why, there are other questions. I think they're even more important for me to ponder. Did God want me to know how real pain could feel so that I could understand the pain of others? Did God want me to know how real heaven is? What did God want me to learn from all my experiences, my death, and my long period of recovery? How can my experiences be of the most benefit to others? After all these years, I don't have the answers to most of those questions either. I have learned a few things and realize that God still has reasons for keeping me alive on earth. I may never know his reasons, and God has no obligation to explain them to me. Even though I don't have full answers to many of my questions, I do have peace. I know I am where God wants me to be, and I know I'm doing the work God has given me. I find comfort in the story recorded in John's Gospel. A man born blind meets Jesus and is healed. After that, he runs around praising God, but his healing is an embarrassment to the religious leaders who have been trying to turn people against Jesus. They interrogate the formerly blind man, trying to force him to admit that Jesus is a sinner, that is, a fraud. The man wisely says, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." John 9:25. In the same way, some may not believe my account. They may think that it was some kind of wish fulfillment during a point of severe trauma. I don't have to defend my experience. I know what happened to me. For those of us whose faith is in the reality of heaven, no amount of evidence is necessary. I know what I experienced. I believe God gave me a hint of what eternity in heaven will be like. I also believe that part of the reason I am still alive, as I have already pointed out, is that people prayed. Dick Honorecker prayed me back to life, to live without brain damage. David Gentiles and the others prayed so that God wouldn't take me back to heaven just yet. I am here. I am alive. And it's because God's purposes have not yet been fulfilled in my life. When God is finished with me, I'll return to the place I yearn to be. I have made my final reservations for heaven, and I'm going back someday, permanently. Prayerfully, I'll see you there too. I pray that this book has been a blessing to you. Since its release in September 2004, 90 Minutes in Heaven, A True Story of Death and Life, has touched millions of souls worldwide. It has been translated into a dozen languages, which has led to several international speaking and book signing tours. There is a certain universality to the questions this book examines. Life after death. Miracles. Finding a meaningful life after a tragedy or loss. And the reality of heaven. Though the response to my story has been personally quite humbling and overwhelming, the worldwide impact has been incredible and amazingly positive. Often crowds have jammed large auditoriums and tents. At other times, a few dozen folks sat and listened intently as I shared my experience. Yet each time, it has been the private moments afterwards that mean the most to me. Some sweet soul will share a tearful personal confession or struggle or hopeful prayers for a better life. Often, it's just meeting someone new with whom I will spend eternity. These encounters, along with thousands of emails, letters, and phone calls, have enriched my life beyond measure. During the years of being bedridden, unending surgeries, and a very questionable future, there were always more questions than answers. As a result of the amazing response to 90 Minutes in Heaven, at least some of those questions have been answered. Each time I have held the hand of some despondent person and prayed with them, each time I gave an altar call after preaching from Sweden to Shreveport and the throngs came forward, each time I sat at the bedside of someone wearing an external fixator and said, "I understand. I knew why I returned from Heaven's Gate. I know without a doubt that I will spend the remainder of my earthly pilgrimage bringing hope." Indeed, one pastor introduced me to his congregation by saying, "He's been a TV personality, a pastor, a minister of youth, a minister to single adults, a minister of education, but today, he comes to us as a minister of hope." Please welcome Don Piper. minister of hope. It may be the most important calling of my restored life. May God help me to be found faithful until He calls me home one last time. I hope I'll cross paths with you this side of glory. If that is not to be, I pray I'll see you at the gate.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.